dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. On February 11th, a community forum on gas drilling was held at the Town Hall in Spencer, New York, sponsored by the Citizens Energy Alliance and ShaleShock.org. It featured Dr. Theo Colburn, an expert on the health effects of gas drilling and hydraulic fracturing, and Jack Ossent of Democracy New York, who we heard a bit from in the previous forum a few weeks ago, on the actions communities can take to save the places they love from corporate predation through rights-based organizing. Dr. Colburn narrated via cell phone while a PowerPoint presentation showing what gas drilling has done to her part of Colorado was screened for the attendees at the town hall. What I can't show you on radio is how hideous these installations are. They look like chemical plants on the outskirts of an industrial wasteland with tanks, pipes, pits, and heavy equipment. And they want to put thousands of these things here. Theo Colburn is senior scientist and director of the Wildlife and Contaminants Project at the World Wildlife Fund and president of the Endocrine Disruption Exchange based in Peonia, Colorado. She started her career as a zoologist late in life after she and her husband retired from a successful pharmacy business to raise sheep. She became alarmed by pollution in the Gunnison River near their ranch in Colorado. Her involvement in Western water issues led her to seek a master's degree in ecology and a PhD in zoology. Her pioneering work on the effects of synthetic chemicals on the endocrine system has led some to compare her to Rachel Carson, who warned the world about the dangers of DDT. The other voice you'll hear in the first section belongs to Autumn Stochek, a farmer in Van Etten, New York, who, based on her personal experience of gas drilling on her land, has become an organizer with the Citizens Energy Alliance to oppose gas drilling in the Marcellus Shale. Here's Dr. Theo Colburn.
Hi, everybody. This evening, to take you on a tour of Western Colorado. Looking back over what my team and I have learned since 2002, it was about that time federal administration-based incentives led to a company coming to my county where I live to tell us that they were going to drill in what we consider our watershed. Then, especially after Congress passed the 2005 Energy Appropriations Bill that had a clause in it that made official the administration's moratorium on the use of the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and RCRA, the Recovery Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. Over the industry, gas activity really began to expand rapidly. Throughout my talk, I will use Colorado as a model for what you might want to think about as natural gas activity commences in your region. But keep in mind that our ecosystem is different from yours, but I know yours well. I was born and raised in northern New Jersey and lived in Sussex County before moving to Colorado in 1964. Now, here you can see the wells and accessory roads on each side of the Colorado River, the water for over 25 million people downstream. And for those of you in the east, look at the size of that river and look at what we're depending upon. You can also see a highway, Interstate Highway I-70, and also Amtrak. if you look very closely in the foreground. This picture looks to the east, where you can see the haze over the Rocky Mountains up towards Aspen. Our major weather systems flow from the southwest to the northeast, and you need to keep weather patterns for your areas in mind as we move throughout this talk, and you'll understand more why. Now, this picture was taken several miles up the river from the last picture, showing how gas activity spread. You should be able to see the Colorado in the bottom left and right-hand corners of the picture. An Amtrak will be right there next to the river, and you'll see I-70 as well. Here, you are seeing approximately one well pad on every 35 acres. I understand in New York, you have a limit of one to every 40 acres. Today in Colorado, as in Wyoming, they can be spaced at one on every 10 acres. So if you look closely, you will see that each well pad has an open evaporation pit. Now, something that New York does not allow, but I'm going to show you this because you're going to have to cope with the water in different ways than we do in the West, but you need to understand the volumes that you're dealing with. So when the gas comes up from the ground, it brings a certain amount of water with it. And for the production life of the well, that water has to be taken out of the gas and put somewhere. So here in the West, it ends up in an open pit or a holding tank above or below ground, and all have to be emptied on a regular basis for the life of the well. Or the water can be trapped and reinjected on the site or piped to a central injection site. You can see a huge open evaporation pit on the side of the mountain, and I'm sure Autumn's pointing at it for you, that services the wells in the area. Now, water trucks on these dirt roads, they don't spend time paving them out here, and we don't want them to anyway. But the water trucks work 24 hours, 7 days a week to haul the water here from all the gas wells that's servicing in those areas. As those pits fill up, they have to come and pump the water out of the pit and then take it to a larger evaporation facility like you see there. Tonight, we will be looking at four stages of natural gas operations where chemicals are found. Drilling, where the hole is made to reach the gas underground. Fracking, where the underground is fractured to facilitate the release of the gas. Processing, where objectionable material is removed from the gas. And waste handling of the objectionable products. The drilling activity you see here, hundreds of feet above the road, is taking place in the headwaters of a river that feeds a reservoir several miles down the road to the left in the picture. That canyon to the left on your screen basically has the creek. It's only a creek, really. It's not a big river that provides the water for that reservoir. There's a reservoir just below, I forgot to tell you, and then below, not on the screen, is the reservoir in which that canyon, the water from that canyon flows into and is held there for our use in the valley downstream. And it provides a large part of the agricultural and drinking water in the valley that I live in. The industrial activity you see here is just a part of 1 year's activity that cannot be seen from the road. I could not capture all the wells also in this picture because I wanted to be able to show people where this activity took place in relation to the road. The activity was on private land that had been fenced off, and so no one can get up in there anymore. We used to like to hike up in there because this land is all surrounded by national forest. But my point here is this. This activity is not taking place in the county I live in. All of the revenue from that activity will go to another county. They're drilling in our watershed. It's in someone else's county. Now, here you see a well. The next picture is you see a well that was being drilled in our in that watershed that I just showed you. And the reserve pit, as you can see, is a pit that's right there at the base of the drill rig. It's lined with white plastic that holds the cuttings from the pipe in one end and then all the other fluids and the drilling muds that come up during the drilling process in the other end. These pits are supposed to be filled in 30 days after the well is completed and goes into operation. Note how close the creek is to the well pad. That's the famous Divide Creek in the background. This is the creek that got a lot of notoriety in the newspaper. You'll see the temporary reserve pit to the left of the drill rig that is collecting cuttings and fluids as well as the well is being dug. And then the large evaporation pit that has been in operation since the first well was completed on that pad to hold the water recovered from the gas as it comes up from the ground. Now, to the right of the drill rig, just to keep you really savvy here, you'll see a stack of pipes. It looks like it's a dark gray, a box of things, so that's a big stack of pipes that they're going to use to finish up that drilling. So we were surprised, however, when we flew over that anyone was drilling on this pad, because several years prior, methane began to bubble up into Divide Creek, escape into the ground and into the neighborhood around, and no matter where you went, you could smell methane. You couldn't even stop by the side of the road. They had signs, don't stop, don't throw a cigarette out. In the end, Encana was fined $371,200 for that mistake, whatever it was. We've never been able to find out exactly what happened there. Now, within the last 2 years, we began to find operations like this. And I expect that this may be what industry will be proposing for you in the East, because you're looking at horizontal drilling operations here. There are many new operations like this in the canyon of the Rhone Plateau in Garfield and Rio Blanco counties in Colorado. I'm sure you've heard about our trying our Rhone. Well, it's here where the latest technology is being tried. And this is supposed to be the most economically efficient way to produce gas. There are two drill rigs operating on this pad, probably using a diamond drill bit that can cut drilling time in more than half. There are already 10 wells here on this pad. If you look down in the lower right, you will see the 10 recovery water or condensate tanks. And also just to the above them, you will see what are called Christmas trees, where the gas comes up from the ground. See also the man camp. That's those two white double trailers, it looked like, where the workers often stay on the pads around the clock until the drilling ceases. And we were told that there would eventually be 28 or 30 wells here, and each well can be fracked 10 times. So easy math means that there could be 280 to 300 fracks done from this pad alone in the area around this drill pad. When the well bore goes directly down underground, that is called vertical drilling. Horizontal drilling involves gradually making the bore bend after the hole reaches a predetermined depth, what they call the kickoff point. And basically, the equipment has to be changed at that point, and then a new kind of drilling facility is put on, and which can then start bending the pipe. So the pipe gets down below below any area where there might be aquifers, and then starts bending. And it takes about 1,200 feet to become fully horizontal. And that lateral bore, then once it reaches out there, can then extend 2,000 feet more beyond where it basically reaches the end of that horizontal stretch. Now, of course, it's interesting. No equipment above ground is needed to do this, and this is one of the reasons that they like this particular approach. Okay, let's go to now, what is fracking? Well, industry has started to use the term stimulation instead of fracking for this operational stage. It sounds more benign, maybe? Wells are fractured in order to increase their productivity. Extremely high levels of pressure are continually maintained down the pipe to pump fluids to various designated depths. And then using the latest state-of-the-art explosives, cut a perforation in the pipe, causing what the industry describes in their own literature as mini earthquakes to facilitate the release of the gas. In this stage, as much as 1 million gallons or more of fluids are injected under high pressure to stimulate the underground and facilitate the release of the gas. In the slick water area where you are, according to one of your New York State reports, the perforations, the companies are planning to use between 2.5 to 3.4 millions of gallons per frack. Whether that has been confirmed or not, I don't know. But several pieces of literature we have read has stated they're going to use that much. Now, here is what we call an artist's conception. And on the top left, you see huge compressor trucks. There would be a lot more than one there that are used to maintain the high pressure throughout the procedure, sometimes as long as 36 hours around the clock. This cannot stop. It's like drilling. Once it starts, it cannot stop or they get into a lot of trouble. Large volumes of diesel fuel must be on the pad to keep all of the equipment running once the procedure starts. Now, notice that the drill rigs now are gone. This happens after the drillers go. It's another company subcontractor that will be doing this kind of work. to the right are dozens of fracking tanks holding the fluids to be injected underground. They're about the size of a huge train car, and the tanks also serve as receptacles for the fracking fluids when they come back up to the surface as the procedure comes to an end and they reduce the pressure. During the procedure, numerous chemicals and various combinations are added to the fluids that are injected underground. The chemicals range from surfactants, lubricants, foamers, propants, plastics like acrylamides, anything to reduce friction like microfine silica, some for bulk and weight, lots of barium sulfate to make the muds heavy, biocides, new complex organic chemicals with long names, as well as chromium and other toxic metals to make sure that the whole system is sterile. They can't have any bacteria in the system, either whether they're anaerobic, they don't need oxygen, or the aerobic bacteria that do need oxygen, they begin to eat the pipe and they cause accidents, and they also convert, especially the anaerobic, convert practically anything underground to, as you well know, hydrogen sulfide or the rotten egg-smelling gas. Then, let me see, they also have antioxidants and acids and alkalis. And these are all, the acids and alkalis are shipped in high concentrations, all added to alter the underground strata to allow methane to escape to the area of least resistance up the pipe. Note the pipe inserted into the ground, penetrating through many strata. Here in the West, gas is found at various depths, from 4,000 to 8,000 feet, and in one area as deep as 10,000 to 12,000 feet. But what you see in that picture is vertical fracking. But Autumn is going to show you that if the pipe had curved off, now let's say right at the bottom of that pipe, we now know it's below all of the aquifers it can go through, it will begin to bend. And then it will bend. And remember, in extending, I told you it takes about 1,200 feet, extending and bending slowly off to one direction or the other before it becomes horizontal. So now the newest technology now uses 6 perforations in the pipe. The pipe that we show there only has 3, and the explosives are sent down the pipe. And now, so instead of one frack going out every 120 degrees, now it's possible to frack with a penetration of every 60 degrees. This is the kind of planned drilling that seems to be in the planning for New York. So now let me see. All right, let's go on next to what is drilling. It's a noisy operation with lots of activity going on and compressors running, again, lit up at night, just like the fracking, as if it were daytime. You can't believe the amount of electricity used to keep this thing lit around the clock. And this can take up to 36 hours. I forgot to tell you, drilling can often take as long as a month, 28 to 30 days. But with the new drill bits, they've cut that time just about in half or more. Now, if you live nearby, you might be able to feel your house jiggle at each explosive event. And you're going to have a lot of trucks going by for many purposes and dump trucks ready to mix in sand. Fracking tanks the size of train cars hold the fluids for the frack and later collect the fluids that come back to the surface. Here you see a fracking tank and dump trucks in a tilt. You see lots of pipes, lots of hoses. And with smaller operation, there are lots of drums of chemicals sitting around on backs of trucks with chemicals ready to be mixed into the slurry. The larger operations, they have these into huge 350 and 500-gallon totes of feeding the various chemicals at the critical time as they're pressuring and pushing pressured fluids underground. Now, estimates range from 30 to 70% of the fluids injected underground during fracking are recovered. But nowhere can we find a study where these quantities were ever measured or analyzed for their ingredients. This is only a single estimation that the industry released many years ago, and no one's ever followed through on requiring any of this to be tested, true research being done on it. Now, the recovered water can be reinjected on site or hauled off to be reinjected at a central site, or in the West, we put these things into open evaporation pits. It's interesting to note that those wells that were drilled up above our valley here, they were never able to recover any of those fluids they injected underground. Anyway, let's go on. Here is what fracking looks like. A lot depends upon where the drilling is taking place and the substrate. But see all the fracking tanks strung out to the right, ready to unload and reload with recovery water. We can count over 60 fracking tanks lined up across that scene that you see there. Now, this picture gives me the opportunity to introduce the fact that water is not the only life support system at risk in producing natural gas. Air quality is also at risk. Up until 3 years ago, air quality got little attention in Colorado until citizens began challenging industry spokespersons that the air is pristine in western Colorado. Public health authorities did not take into consideration the amount of diesel that is burned to produce natural gas. Now, in this picture, you can see the exhaust coming up over in the sky to the left, above where the generator tanks and all the heavy equipment is doing the fracking. Okay, let's see, where are we here? Diesel fuel and gasoline exhaust contains nitrogen oxides, the NOx, as well as the volatile organic compounds, which are called VOCs. And just so you know, methane is a volatile organic compound. And it is estimated that a large percentage of the gas that is released from the ground actually escapes. It becomes fugitive. And if they lose it, I mean, basically, if equipment was built properly and things were done right, they would lose far less methane. So you've got methane adding to this problem as well. But when the NOx and the VOCs come up and move into the air in presence of sunlight, they produce what is called ground-level ozone. So here in this picture, you see stationary and mobile equipment required produce and deliver natural gas can cause an urban-like smog problem rich in ozones in areas of high production. And what you need to keep in mind is that it's no longer profitable to work in areas of low production. So wherever the activity is going to take place now, it's going to be a high production area. But we need ozone in the stratosphere to protect us from ultraviolet light. But at ground level, it poses a serious threat to all animals, including humans and plants, and also the trees in our forest. One molecule of ozone can burn a hole in the deep alveolar tissue in your lungs, where your body releases carbon dioxide in exchange for oxygen. Very, very important part of the lung. It is well documented that daily exposure to ozone leads to early aging of the lung. They become brittle, dry out. The lungs cannot repair this kind of damage. It is permanent. So constant exposure becomes cumulative in its effects. Chronic ozone exposure can cause asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and other pulmonary disorders. Children are especially vulnerable because their lungs continue to grow and enlarge until about age 18. As they mature in the presence of ozone, their alveoli production is reduced, and they end up with brittle lungs in their mid-20s, like those of an 80-year-old person. Ozone was always thought to be only an urban problem caused by the exhaust from automobiles and volatile organic compounds, or the VOCs coming off from the gas fumes, the same VOCs that are released from natural gas operations. So we now have in the West an urban air pollution phenomenon that no one ever anticipated would happen. And it's been getting very, very little publicity. We came upon this fracking incident as we were looking for the tunnel that had been drilled through a mountain to reduce the long trip to a county road. These companies just seem to think they can take over the country. And as you can see, they just decided they'd dig a hole through the mountain, and it would save them lots of miles getting to a nearby town, and also get their trucks off to the main highway. But you can see on this bed as well, there are already 8 completed wells, if you look to the left and below the pad, and you'll see the 8 condensate water tanks. There are actually 35 green tracking tanks, each about the size of a train car, nested side by side to the left of the pad, about 35 or more along the back, and zooming in, which you can't do, but we can. In our office, we counted almost 100 tanks on this pad. You can see the white cabs of at least 8 generator trucks lined up near the hole where all the activity is taking place. So a great deal of energy is spent on drilling and fracking chemicals, fracking for natural gas. I'm sorry. I'm looking ahead here now. Okay, so now we're going to get to processing. When the gas first comes from the ground, the water must be stripped off, as well as other noxious gases, such as benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene. These are called the BTEXs, B-T-E-X, and other heavy hydrocarbons. So before the natural gas, methane, moves into the local delivery pipeline, it has to be dried and cleaned up a little. So here is a pad where drilling has ceased and the wells are now set up to produce gas, perhaps for another 25 years. There are five wells drilled on this pad. Now you'll see a shadow in the foreground on the left side of the picture. That's a shadow of one of the five Christmas trees actually on the site. Now you can get a close-up of what a Christmas tree looked like. This is where the gas comes up from the ground. To the right, you can see a solar panel that constantly takes the air temperature, and when it gets near freezing, it releases methanol, good old wood alcohol, in that white tank into the gas coming out of the ground to prevent the pipes from freezing. This is a very important safety factor because if the pipes begin to freeze, they can get into all kinds of problems with pressure and explosions and bursting pipes. Now, to the left and to the back of this picture, you can see what are called 5-glycol dehydrators. As the gas comes out of the ground, it is passed through a liquid called ethylene glycol that attracts water. It just sucks the water out of the gas and in that separator column, that column that's standing up there in the back. The column is then heated and the water is evaporated off to condense over into the tanks, which I'll show you in a minute. Those noxious gases, such as BTEX, are allowed to vent off here. The orange arrow points at a pipe for flaring. When the pressure gets high enough, these things automatically flare. So over the lifetime of this well, there's going to be a flaring operation every now and then, unless they learn how to begin to trap those gases other ways. Now, keep in mind that throughout the process, you are seeing, as I said before, natural gas is escaping a well, and a great deal of money is lost in the production of natural gas through escaping or a fugitive gas. And there are a lot of new technologies out there that are available for the companies to use. But, of course, capital outlay up front is a little more than most want to spend. Now, here are the five holding tanks that were on the pad. Sorry that the way we took this picture, we could not see it all. But we wanted to get off that pad fast and didn't take time to run around and do much photographing. But these tanks are supposed to be bermed so that if 75% of the fluid in the tank were to leak, all of it would be contained on the site. And I've looked at a lot of these berms, and it's very difficult for me to see the berm being able to hold all the water in one of those tanks. But anyway, from this stage on, for the life of this well, as long as it keeps producing gas, water trucks are now going to come and empty these tanks and haul off that condensate water to an evaporation pit or a reinjection site, whatever the technology happens to be. Vehicles are listed as mobile sources when we talk about sources for the nitrogen oxides and the VOCs. This is what you would call stationary equipment. And there's a lot of stationary equipment involved in getting the gas to your home. Actually, to get a permit, a producer is supposed to estimate how much fugitive natural gas is escaping and other gases that come up with the methane. And we've often wondered if anybody has ever bothered to go out and check on what the companies are reporting. This is a compressor unit, one of the many needed along the pipeline, keep the pressure high enough so that there is no backflow from the main delivery lines. Now, this is a stationary unit. Here you see two separator columns and no holding tanks. And since we could, since no one could be found here to talk to, we can only speculate that this is one of the new units where produced water is being stored in an underground tank, or perhaps being piped to a larger open evaporation pit. If you look, there's a 6-inch pipe there. And 6-inch pipe out here is usually used for moving along the recovered water. And we think that's what's happening here. But keep in mind, again, in order to get the gas from the primary delivery system into the large long-distance system that is run at 400 pounds per square inch. This unit has to be producing 500 pounds per square inch. Now, those 500 horsepower fans are releasing high levels of HX and other heavy volatiles. And because in behind those fans are the generators in that building. If this photo were taken with an infrared camera, you would only be able to see the gases swirling around, blocking out what is behind. They take over in the picture. We have not been able to find anyone with an infrared camera to run around with us and just be able to take these pictures. But lots of fugitive gas and VOCs are probably being lost right here at this little station, which looks very benign as you drive by on the backcountry road. And as I said, there is technology available today that in some of these closed systems, they can capture as much as 95% of the volatiles that would come off. And as I said, also, the capital outlay is a little high. But for the amount of gas that the new systems capture, these new units are paying off in 3 years where they've been used. We know of one company in Colorado who has tried to use, and we have a lot of companies in Colorado who are not trying to use. Now, gas has to be polished once more before it enters the interstate commercial delivery lines. And here you see a picture of what is called the Williams Ignacio Ute Reservation Natural Gas Refinery in southwestern Colorado that releases huge volumes of foul-smelling nitrogen and sulfur-based volatile compounds. Because gas production is so high in this region of the state, British Petroleum, actually built another refinery up the road several miles, which we could not see from the road. But in your planning, you need to take into consideration that something like this is part of what you're going to expect as a lot of wells go into production. And then this plant also takes water out of a local river called the Florida River. It's spelled like Florida, but they pronounce it Florida, to wash the gas after the noxious substances have been removed. And then of course, Basically, there, again, is local use of water and I'll show you something a little bit later. We'll get back to this. Now, waste fluids and sludge can be handled in a number of ways, and the following pictures are shown only to demonstrate the huge volumes of water that we must deal with in the production of natural gas. And in the West, we can count on evaporation. In the East, it is not going to work. Your state was very wise to ban the use of evaporation pits on well pads. So you're one step ahead of where we were. But pits like this service a large number of wells, usually for one operator. Look closely, and you should be able to see the red cab on the water truck unloading. And we know this is a Halliburton operation because their cabs are red. So we know the companies by the colors of their cabs. A unit like this is another source for nitrogen oxides and VOCs. And also, these open pits are supposed to be netted, but we could see no netting in this picture. This facility accepted truckloads of fluids from small developers and wildcatters for a radius of over 35 miles or more. None of the units I showed you ever monitored what the trucks are unloading, and that I would say that for the one that we just, Halliburton's not monitoring what they're unloading. But when the pits dry out and are only oily sludge, the residue is then land-farmed, believe it or not. It is dipped into the soil, hauled off, and supposed to not biodegrade. And, of course, I mentioned all of those biocides and these huge land-farms where they go in every day and disk these things in. And then, of course, when the wind blows, it's dry and it's dusty. Not a very good situation at all. Now, this is the evaporation pit for the wash water from the Indian Reservation. Note that the cannon-like apparatus shooting the water into the air to assist evaporation. Now, although some water and toxic components are removed from the gas before it enters the local pipeline, the gas still had to go to the refinery, remember, where it was further cleaned. Now, these refineries are not situated generally anywhere near where the gas drilling is taking place, but near the pipeline. Oh, before we leave this, I just wanted you to see the berm around this pond and see how it's beginning to erode and crack. And the day we were there, there was actually what we call no freeboard left in this huge, huge evaporation pit. The water was right up to the brim. So, and we also have learned from Canada that these plants pull off large amounts of mercury and other toxic metals and other hydrocarbons found in underground organic deposits. Your organization should be alert and watch for notices of intent to build one of these units. And as I said, for economic purposes, they will most likely be built near a major pipeline. Now, let's get serious. In 2002, several non-governmental organizations, individuals, and even reporters began asking me about the products that are used during the production of natural gas and began sending me the names of some of the products they knew were being used. Well, back then, responding to their questions was very low priority on my agenda. But as more and more information started coming into TEDx, it was apparent that someone would have to be assigned to handle the material. About that time, Dr. Mary Bachron joined my team, and with the enthusiasm of an MIT pre-doc working on her PhD, she wanted to become a specialist in fracking. She spent a summer with us. On an NSF grant, the National Science Foundation grant, they started to systematically set up a database to look at the long list of chemicals that we had at hand. As they did, a consistent pattern or profile of the health effects kept popping up based on the 14 traditional toxicological categories used in government publications. The last time this program was updated for Colorado, there were 247 products and 278 chemicals on the list, and there are over 3,000 citations behind this list. 93% of the products had identifiable health effects. The other 7% represent the products for which we had no information at all because it was proprietary, and there was one product for which we could find no information about its health effects. It was just an indescribable chemical. Of those products that had health effects, 14% had 1 to 3 effects. 86% had 4 to 14 effects. And what surprised us was to find that 43% of the products on our list are endocrine disruptors, which is our specialty. Chemicals that can interfere with the development of individuals before they are born and cause irreversible life-term changes in their health, how they function. And wildlife, including fish and birds, have proven to be sensitive to chemicals of this nature at ambient concentrations. So what we did was take and start looking at the major pathways of exposure. Okay, are you going to be exposed through water? Are you going to be exposed through air? It was important to look more closely at what could get in our water and air. So we broke out the chemicals that are water-soluble and looked at them alone. And now I have to walk over to my computer, or maybe Autumn would read to you what it says below those bars. The bars tell you how often or the frequency of certain health category has been identified among all the chemicals on the list.
The categories are skin and eye, respiratory, gastrointestinal, liver, neurological, ecological, cardiological, immune, kidney, developmental, reproductive, cancer, mutagenic, endocrine, and other.
What I want you to notice is, where is cancer? It's way over on the right. The largest percentage of these chemicals are not carcinogens, but look at the other health effects. So, and you'll see that the systems most associated are the skin and eye, sensory organs, the respiratory, stomach and liver, and the brain and the nervous system. Those adverse health effects expressed by those systems in many cases would occur shortly after exposure, conditions that may not often be brought to the attention of clinicians, such as itching skin, burning eyes, sore throats, nausea, headaches, sinusitis, and so on. Or if severe, would be brought to the emergency room first. The other health categories include the disorders that would not be expressed immediately, but could turn up as chronic health problems months or years later. And they could never be traced directly to industry exposure. No physician could do it. Now here you see the profile associated with the volatile chemicals. That is the same profile, but with greater frequency and more linked with the chronic long-term disorders. It is important to point out here where cancer lies on the grass, which I did. Oh, I said that earlier. Okay. So keep in mind that most risk analyses are based on cancer. And if that risk is low, it is often assumed that the chemical is safe. So in essence, this analysis reveals that the risk of cancer is low, but that is not true for many other chronic disorders. Now, this is a picture of, and I'm pointing this out because I'm so concerned about the workers whose health is not taken into consideration by the companies that they're working for. This is a picture of just one of three 400-bed man camps to house the gas field workers, set up just by one company to make sure that they have enough people to work around the clock. These people are housed either on the pads, like I showed you, or in these man camps. And they work 12 hours on and 12 hours off for 30 days, and then are off for 2 weeks, or 1 or 2 weeks, and then back to work. Men coming off their shifts are exhausted, some with severe headaches, and have many other complaints matching some of what I mentioned above. The pay is high enough to drain truck drivers, utility workers, waitresses, and other employees away from local and county jobs so that then the town in this area then have a difficult time finding people to do the work they used to keep their communities going. I just want to throw in some of the personal aspects that you must take into consideration. Now, in some cases, these people work on contract and get no health insurance. So that's something to keep in mind in your planning, because there are going to be, they need people and they need them around the clock, and they need people who are willing to work long, hard hours and not say much. So now I know men are being flown into Colorado from Canada to work for 4 weeks, never leave the gas patch until they fly back to Canada for 2 weeks, and then they're back here again. Now, for a long time, we believed what the developers were telling us, that drilling muds are benign, they're safe, until we got an urgent request to see if we had any information about 20 products for which the material safety data sheet that must be attached to these products were being sent FedEx to us. From where there had been a drilling blowout. There was a serious blowout during a routine drilling operation in Wyoming, and this was a new well where the drillers at a depth of 8,000 feet hit a strata of extremely high pressure, and a lot of mud blew back up. Drilling muds began to erupt in the regions of the well and, unfortunately, near homes. The ooze came out of the road cuts and ran down the county road. It took 57 hours to get this eruption under control. The company involved agreed to give the local authorities the names of what they were using during drilling, but it was many days afterwards. It was not surprising to hear that the people living in the area had to be evacuated using respirators because of the noxious fumes, and they had to stay away from their homes for days. This incident, fortunately, though, led to the state of Wyoming to come up with a comprehensive remediation plan, which you need to look into. The plan requires the company to carry out remediation over many, many years to meet full completion. Restoration in the West and remediation is a little more tough than it is in the East. Things don't grow back as fast here as they do there. But this could very well become a model for other states to incorporate. This is needed badly under present conditions, where there is no government oversight of the industry and where now the responsibility has fallen back on the states to regulate. Now, this graph shows what we were able to learn about the chemicals spilled in a fracking mixing chemical truck accident in Garfield County over here near us. Three vehicles came down at the same time on a narrow county road. There were trucks, you know, they were the usual large trucks that everyone drives around out here. And the truck was heading to a fracking when it spilled 318 gallons of material that contained four products. As you see here, there were 15 different chemicals involved, and you can see how they fell out by health category. Over on the very left, they all would have had an effect on the environment. Right over there on the left, eco, fish, invertebrates, plants. Now, here you see the profile. Well, those were the water solubles. No, right? Okay, well, the volatiles, they pop out, and you can see 100% of them would have had a number of those effects. And then, of course, there were not as many water-soluble ones, but click on the water-soluble, and you will see 100% of them, of those effects were found in the water-soluble chemicals. So now, guess who arrived on the scene to work on this? The state police. They're the first called. They have no idea what to do, nor do local firemen. And out here, the local firemen are also called. So these are the kind of things you need to take into consideration, too. Then we were sent the test results from six New Mexico evaporation pits that are scheduled to be shut down in the near future. The health effects of the 51 chemicals and metals that were detected produced a health pattern even more hazardous than the patterns of the chemicals we found in our spreadsheets for the state of New Mexico. In addition, some chemicals were found at extremely high concentrations, well above state and federal safety levels. Only eight chemicals detected during analysis matched the chemicals in our spreadsheets. So we went back to the lawyer who got us all this material and said, please, give us the name of the lab. We need to check with the lab on this. They went back and looked at the chemical testing protocol used in that New Mexico study, and we found that except for 7 toxic metals and naphthalene, they did not test for the other chemicals that we have on our list that are being used in New Mexico. But we did find that over 90% of the chemicals reported in those pits are on the CERCLA, the Superfund list of toxic chemicals. That's a Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, and that's CRIM, the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act of 2006. That was CERCLA 2005. So, anyway, now how are those things getting there? Well, we don't know much. They don't tell us what's on those MSDS sheets. We only get very little information. That we're trying to work, but with little information we get. So now, we barely get a day that we can take a picture in the west without a blue haze destroying our vistas. And here you see the high country where gas development is encroaching on our beautiful forest and mountain meadows. And by the way, that happens to be a picture of the mountain meadows where I took my ewes in the summer up in the high country. And in a major western watershed, we never had this blue haze back in the 1970s. Just a few weeks ago, a group of scientists at NOAA reported wintertime ozone in the Wyoming Jonah Pineal Anticline, one of the major gas fields in Wyoming, rising to more than 140 parts per billion. EPA has come up with the idea that maybe 70 parts per billion or a little more is safe, but I worked on a report for Congress in 1990, I can't remember how many years ago, where we know anything above 40 parts per billion can be harmful to human health. Here we were 100 parts per billion higher. Our Rocky Mountain forests lie right in the path of the air pollutants from gas and oil development and could easily be caught up in an ozone plume. Ozone goes up in the sky, and the gases interact in the presence of sunlight, and that air mass may be moving along so that even the production of the ozone may not be directly above where the drilling is taking place. But ozone plumes, we know, can extend well over 200 miles. So like the alveoli in our lungs, the stomata in the leaves on deciduous trees and needles on conifers suffer ozone burn. The reduced growth rates increase susceptibility to disease, and early death has been blamed on ozone in evergreen forests, commercial tree species, and food and forage crops across the U.S., as I said, starting and measurable at 50 parts per billion. A week after the NOAA report, the prestigious journal Science published an article with the headline, "Widespread Increase of Tree Mortality Rates in the Western United States." The trees in our mountain forests in the West are the keepers of our water. They make it possible for us to have water year-round. Not only does ozone as an air pollutant pose a direct threat to human health, it also poses a covert threat to our already marginal freshwater supply in the West. You already have ozone problems, urbanization in the East. You have to take air pollution as seriously as water pollution in your planning. And what you may find, as we have here now, air pollution may prove to be a more imminent threat to our air and our health than water pollution, which may take longer to creep up on us. So we need to know a lot more. The public should have access to the following: every ingredient in the product being used, the quantity or concentration of every chemical used. In other words, we want the complete formulation of every product. What are they using to fill those drums up? What are those fluids that are, you know, when you only have 2 or 8% of your chemical that you're using, what is the rest of the material in that drum? These dangerous chemicals are being mixed in large quantities in the gas fields, also by people who have no idea what they're using. Even the bosses on the jobs have no idea what is being used, but they stand by the company's mantra that the chemicals are safe. Now, the public should also know the amount of liquid fluid injected and recovered during fracking, and thus how much remains underground. Chemical composition of what is in pits on the well pads and in the off-site waste disposal pits need to be reported. Studies are needed on waste mobilization through water, air, and soil. And from a life support system in the West, we better find out how much water of the water being used to produce natural gas is being returned to the Colorado River system. And you are going to have that problem, I believe, in New York. You have commitments downstream of how much water the people below you are supposed to be getting. I wonder if this is going to affect the Colorado River Compact commitments to the states downstream. But no one, doesn't seem, is paying much attention to water quality. We're still fighting over who owns the water. Now, because of the magnitude of the industrial activity involved, too many people can be affected. And what the mantra has been for those working in the West, the nonprofits, we want to know full disclosure. And that's our tune. Realistic, comprehensive water monitoring programs must be set up that include numerous downslope sites miles away at outcroppings, watering holes, springs, creeks, and domestic wells where chemicals injected underground might eventually surface. Although it is too late already in some areas, baseline monitoring of water quality and ozone should commence immediately in all other areas where activity is going to start. Someone should be charged with quantifying both agricultural and drinking water depletion. Our information reveals not only immediate, but chronic and latent hazards posed to human health and wildlife health, from chemical contamination being introduced into our watershed, but also an emerging threat to our air that will not go away until the gas fields shut down and stationary sources associated with processing and delivering gas are no longer in operation. And this generally is not discussed when the impacts of gas production are under consideration. And I'm going to close here now, but I want to show you a list of resources. These are the national groups that we've been working with. And the third group down, I don't have it in front of me, is the Air Pollution Group, a wonderful new group that just started, and I don't know their new name. Autumn, can you read it for me?
Wild Earth Guardians?
That's it, Wild Earth Guardians. They are doing the air work. Excellent. They've already filed delay movements recently, so you need to look into their activity. And also, without the support of the government, the organizations and the people that you see on the screen, we would not have been able to bring you this presentation. And at the very last, please write down that website address. Your timing could not have been better. Yesterday released its updated website, and I recommend that you go to the site and look at our program on natural gas. We are in the process of updating each site and each state. More and more will begin to appear there. And most important, go to the Endocrine Disruption Program and look at the fossil fuel connection, and it will give you all the more reason to want to seek other more sustainable sources of energy.
Dr. Theo Colburn, an expert in the health effects of gas drilling, narrating a slideshow via telephone at a community meeting last week in Spencer, New York. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We'll return to the Citizens Energy Alliance Town Hall with questions from the audience for Dr. Theo Colburn, which I will revoice for your convenience. There's a range in companies of who is more or less environmentally responsible. Is there any organization publishing ratings of these companies?
I have a feeling that if they go to the Environmental Working Group, which was on that list of resources, EWG, that's the kind of they do. And you might contact them. They need to look at some of the material that they've been releasing. I'll tell you quite frankly, we're dealing with 100 companies. Remember, a small man with a drill rig can come along and purchase one of those leases and start drilling. It doesn't have, and there are a lot of those around. We call them wildcatters.
Is there any product for in-home use to proactively protect yourself from groundwater contamination?
Absolutely not. No. But the people who have been having problems here, many of them, they didn't even know they had methane until it got to the point where it was there so much it began to foam. Methane is odorless, remember? But one man definitely, where he was in his instance, he tasted something wrong with the water, but he had a cabin and it was isolated, so he drank it, and he became very, very, very ill. You'll be able to taste some of these things, and if your water, especially if you have your own home domestic well, you really need to be very sensitive to changes. I'm just hoping that too many of you don't have domestic wells that you're using, like a community water supply.
I think most of us have private water.
You have your private wells. Well, that's the way we were on our farm. And I became very concerned because there's one product, there's certain products maybe you could get banned in the state. There's one called 2-butoxyethanol, 2-BE, when I read about it, and this is how I got involved, really, when this Gunnison Energy Corporation said they were going to be drilling in our watershed, somehow, and I don't know how they got it, because that's the only recipe or formula I have ever seen for what was going to be used during fracking. And I have that recipe to this day, and I look at it and I marvel. But it was handed to me, and someone said to me, well, you're supposed to know about water. You went to college to become a water expert. What is this stuff? So I looked and found out about, and the only thing that really caught my eye, because it was bentonite there in sand, and a couple of other chemicals, potassium chloride. I mean, it was a long list, but nothing that you would consider lethal. But then this 2-BE popped up, 2-butoxyethanol. And anyway, I ended up finding about a 4-inch stack high of number of studies the government had done or had, had asked to be done on this product. And the amazing thing about it was that it's odorless. It's colorless. It mixes well with water. You'd never know it's there. It's called miscible. And it evaporates at room temperature. And, of course, as I sat and read that, and then I read the health effects, which are very bizarre, very different than anything you would expect, I said, oh, my goodness, because we know groundwater doesn't mix underground. Groundwater moves in slugs. And underground is like, moving the toothpaste down the tube. And all I could think was, oh, God, we have this well, our submerged pump on the farm. And what if that slug should happen to come by the end of our pipe and that came into our home? We wouldn't even know it was there. And that's when I got very concerned and said, my goodness, products like this should not be allowed to be used. Well, anyway, what happened was I wrote a letter to the regional forester and the regional BLM managers who were issuing the permits for this to be done and described the physical characteristics. Well, actually, you'll be able to find this on our website. Go to our website. And in it, I described, the health effects. I put that thing down for 2 years. And 2 years later, almost the day, I got a phone call from a woman who called and told me, she had a rare adrenal tumor, which this product in the laboratory basically caused, but it didn't cause that many, but it was rare. And that's when I really decided, I guess my team and I are just going to have to look into this. So, and there are other chemicals like that, and we're trying to focus in on those. It's very difficult, and prioritize and say, okay, what kind of chemicals should we say maybe you can ban that are not going to be used in the state? Why don't we look at those chemicals that have 14 health effects first, the ones that are used most frequently? And quite frankly, I'm so short of help now. I need staff. The poor woman who works with me on this, her husband is very ill in the hospital. And but we are, we're going to stick to this, and hopefully we'll be able to move forward. But that's the kind of thing that maybe we can provide some more information on. But as for your own water, you're just going to have to be very careful. Be conscious of where the activity is taking place.